From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, the National Football League and public money.
About 70% of the cost of building and operating the NFL stadiums has been paid for by the public.
The humans who want to become Martians in 2025.
Everything I've done academically and professionally has been for one reason, to leave this Earth and represent humanity on Mars.
Plus, actor Barkhad Abdi earns an Oscar nomination right out of the gate.
This was my first time acting or even thinking about acting.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Two conference championship games tomorrow will determine the teams that advance to the Super Bowl, and the matchups could not be more exciting. Denver and New England, Brady and Manning for Pete's sake. The other game, pitting San Francisco against Seattle, might just feature the two best teams in the league. I expect both games will be better than the Super Bowl. You can tell how much I love the game, and many Americans feel the way I do. And America shows its love, giving back to the NFL with tax breaks and building stadiums with public money. But does the multi-billion dollar business really need the help? Or is the NFL getting a free ride? That's our cover story today.
NFL headquarters at 345 Park Avenue in New York. You walk into that facility, you think you're in the headquarters of Goldman Sachs.
That's Greg Easterbrook, author of King of Sports, Football's Impact on America.
That facility is registered as a not-for-profit.
The National Football League is a tax-exempt organization, even with a commissioner that makes nearly $30 million a year. And from the tax code to big stadium deals, critics say they're getting millions of public dollars that would be better spent elsewhere. Now, a lot of organizations in America are considered tax-exempt, charities, trade groups, and NPR. The NFL League Office is organized as a 501c6, a part of the tax code that exempts things like business leagues and chambers of commerce and trade associations. But that's just the league office, not the individual franchises.
There is no tax break at the NFL for revenue earned from things like ticket sales, jersey sales, or corporate sponsorships or television money.
Jeremy Spector is outside tax counsel for the NFL and a partner at Covington & Burling LLP. He says the NFL, including teams, brings in about $10 billion of annual taxable income.
None of those revenues are escaping tax. It's the league office, that organizational or administrative arm, that's exempt.
That administrative arm handles things like writing the rule book, hiring referees, running the college draft, and negotiating stadium deals. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma says it's absurd to call the NFL a trade association. He's proposed changing the tax code to end the exemption and start collecting taxes from pro sports organizations like the NFL or the PGA.
I'm saying in a time when we have a $640 billion deficit, and that's the best we've had in 5 years, shouldn't very wealthy to-do sports leagues pay their share?
Jeremy Spector, lawyer for the NFL, says sports organizations are being unfairly singled out.
I think it's very dangerous if Congress starts picking and choosing which industry or which industry trade associations are eligible for the tax exemption.
Critics say the tax exemption is just one way professional football gets a handout from taxpayers. Another way is big-time stadium deals. Take, for example, the Dallas Cowboys. Back in the late 90s, the Cowboys and their owner, Jerry Jones, began plans to expand their current stadium or build a new one. He shopped in and around the city of Dallas for years, asking for public assistance to fund the stadium. He found an audience in Arlington, Texas, a city just outside of Dallas. And the price tag for the public, $325 million. Arlington Mayor Robert Kluck saw an opportunity for the city and a tough sell to voters.
It was difficult. It certainly was. We explained to them how it was going to work, where it was going to be located, the amenities that it would contain. After we explained it thoroughly, it really was not very difficult.
To pay for that, voters in Arlington agreed to raise taxes, a higher sales tax, plus hikes on rental cars and hotel rooms. Cowboys Stadium opened to the public in May 2009. Mayor Kluck says the economic benefits are tangible. He says groups use the stadium throughout the year, not just on game days. And he says building the stadium has increased property values in the surrounding area. All in all, he says, the stadium was worth it.
I'm sure you could find somebody who's against it. I have not seen that person since it was completed. I think people are very, very happy with it.
We decided to test out Mayor Kluck's assertion with some locals at Maverick Sports Grill, just a mile away from the stadium. Dan O'Connell is the bar's manager.
When the original votes were cast for the tax increase, I voted against it. But in retrospect, I think it was probably a good thing for the city. It seems to draw a lot of people in on the weekends and during games.
Jordan Fitzgerald doesn't agree and doesn't like the tax bill.
It was not worth it whatsoever. Why? Because my tax money went to a damn stadium instead of my own benefit?
Same goes for Alexia Whitehead.
I guess it pisses me off that, you know, my taxes go to that and I don't even care about football, so.
But some people, like Robert Henning, think the stadium put Arlington on the map.
I love it. It's a worldwide just icon for football, which I think is the greatest sport on the planet. And it's bringing a lot of income to our city, and it's bringing more people here. They see the promise, and that's what we want.
Author Greg Easterbrook says he's heard that argument before, that stadiums boost local economies. But he says it doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
Studies consistently show that the same amount of money spent on civic infrastructure, whether it's roads, bridges, subway tunnels, if you spend on infrastructure, it has a multiplier effect every day of the year. If you spend on NFL stadia, it has a multiplier effect 10 or 12 days of the year. In terms of civic investment, football makes no sense at all, not only its lack of multiplier effect on the local economy, but far more importantly, all the owners are billionaires. The league has $10 billion of annual revenue. It can pay for its own stadiums.
So can you give us a sense of scale in terms of the subsidies? How much is the NFL coming out ahead?
Research shows that about 70% of the cost of building and operating the NFL stadiums has been paid for by the public. I estimate if you roll it all together, subsidies, tax favors, etc., it's roughly $1 billion a year. Most NFL stadia either don't pay any property taxes or pay drastically reduced property taxes compared to comparable businesses. MetLife Stadium, where this year's Super Bowl will be held in New Jersey, and wish me luck because I'll be freezing my keister off at that game, should pay about $20 million a year in local property taxes if it were taxed at the comparable rate for similar businesses in the same county. It pays $6 million a year through a political agreement that exempted the billionaire ownership families of the Jets and Giants that jointly own that stadium from the kind of taxes that are paid by mere average people.
Leaving aside, though, if it's not, I mean, not to sound silly about it, but even if it's not sensible, you know more than anybody how much people love this game. And there's that threat hanging over cities of, you know, you don't want your beloved team to go away, go somewhere else. It's better.
The most recent example of that is Minnesota. A year ago, the billionaire ownership family of the Minnesota Vikings essentially blackmailed the state legislature into giving them $500 million for a new facility. The key decision was made by the governor of Minnesota. His choices were two. One, he can say, I'm the man who kept the Vikings in Minnesota. Or maybe if they left, I don't think they would have left. I think the odds were very small. But if they'd left, then he would have been blamed for losing the Vikings. And in the former case where he boasts about, I'm the man who kept them here, he can claim, and this will create thousands of jobs, even though that's transparently phony. If he does something that results in the Vikings leaving, then he's blamed. Meanwhile, the money that's been spent, it's all down the road. Some other politician will have to produce it.
Greg Easterbrook, author of King of Sports. Even if the public loses money in the end, there's that powerful variable in the equation, the intense love fans have for their teams. Again, Jeremy Spector from the NFL.
People like to have an NFL team at home. They like going to the stadium, and they don't want to lose that. And if the public at large or through their representatives decides that they want to spend some public dollars to keep the team there, to help build a new stadium, you know, that's their decision to make. I don't deny that these are tough decisions for a community. There are limited dollars, and the communities have to decide where they want to spend them.
The people who want to roll back the favors for the NFL are having a hard time finding allies. After 4 months, Senator Coburn has only one co-sponsor for his bill, and he's not at liberty to say who it is. And this week, Senator Coburn, this one lone voice in Congress against public help for pro football, announced he's retiring at the end of this congressional session. Rhinoceros horns have long been a target for poachers, And recently, demand has increased and pushed up the prices on the black market.
Rhino horns have gone from being what has been a staple of Chinese traditional medicine for hundreds of years to being something that is a talisman of conspicuous consumption by high rollers and members of the new wealthy elite.
That's Adam Higginbotham. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek, and he says that the horns, by weight, are now more valuable than cocaine or heroin. And one group of poachers, far away from the rhino's native habitat, have tried to profit.
They decided that it was much easier to go after rhinos that were long dead and therefore easier to get hold of and less angry about the prospect of being hunted.
We're talking about stuffed rhinos, museum pieces. Here's how this played out. A few years back, museums across Europe began to get suspicious visits.
So they would go into the museums during the day and have a look around, ask to see any rhino exhibits that the museum curators recommended or anything unusual that they had in the museums. And they'd wander around, find out where they were, take some pictures of them with their phones, and then they'd leave. And then frequently what would happen is a few days or a few hours later, somebody else would come in, and on one occasion, a couple of men distracted the museum guards or the curators by having a chat with them about something they thought was interesting. While their accomplices ran upstairs, one got onto the shoulders of another and using a hammer smashed the horn off the nose of a stuffed rhino trophy that was mounted on a wall. And then they just ran out again with it.
Not exactly cat burglar jewel thief types.
No, there's no kind of Cary Grant or Ocean's 11-style sophistication to any of these robberies.
Since 2011, 15 European countries reported 67 similar robberies. Authorities and museum curators were at a loss, until investigators discovered the thieves all came from one area.
It turned out, after several years of investigation, that this series of apparently baffling robberies was being organized by a single network who are part of the Irish traveling community. And they originate in this small town, 2 hours' drive out of Dublin.
Higginbotham describes Irish travelers as a group of merchants who spend much of the year trading antiques around Europe and the rest of the world.
They're just experts at it. They do it every day, nonstop, and they've been doing it since the age of 10 or 11 or 12. So, I mean, you know, they're up there with any Harvard graduate when it comes to, like, figuring out how to close a deal.
That's Eamon Dillon. He's an editor and crime reporter for the Sunday World in Dublin. He says suspicion fell on one group of traders known as the Rathkeel Rovers, named for their small town in central Ireland. Dillon says the group brought their knowledge of rare commodities and Europe's complicated jurisdictions to the world of rhino horn smuggling.
Obviously, Europe, you know, there wouldn't necessarily be a lot of cooperation between different police forces. So, you know, it's quite easy for someone to organize a theft in the Czech Republic while, you know, waiting in a van 50 miles away in Germany or in Austria or wherever.
In 2010, Europol organized a joint task force of 33 European nations to bring down the rovers. Last September, they staged several raids and arrested a handful of the gang's leaders. The punishments varied. Some men were fined, others had their charges dropped, and a few still await sentencing. Perhaps as a consequence, rhino horn thefts have declined over the past few months. But Adam Higginbotham has another explanation for why that may be.
Aside from the arrests and the Europol operation, one Irish policeman told me that the reason that the number of robberies has declined is simply because the Rathkeel Rovers have stolen them all.
That's Adam Higginbotham. He's a contributor to Bloomberg Businessweek. His article in the January issue is called The Rhino Racket. From NPR West, it's All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. It's time now for the new and the next. Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. Each week he joins us to talk about what's new and what's next. Welcome back, Carlos.
Good to be with you.
First up, you have Will Packer, who's not a household name yet, but he's a film producer to watch this year.
This young guy from Florida, who was always a movie lover, finally seems to be getting his big break. He's partnered up with the hot comedian of the day, Kevin Hart. They've got a series of films coming out, and just to hear the backstory of this former electrical engineer who graduated magna cum laude from Florida A&M, but who's turned his attention to the movies, it's exciting to see what he's building. And he now has a big deal with Universal Studios, which is bringing a series of films this year.
Okay. I wanted your blessing in asking your sister to marry me.
You want to marry my sister? Show me that you're worthy of her.
How am I supposed to do that?
I'm going to take you on a ride along.
And it's funny because I had noticed how it looked like with these upcoming films, especially that Kevin Hart is everywhere. And it turns out that Will Packer is the guy that seems like he's behind a lot of this.
They've teamed up in the past and kind of nurtured each other's career. And now not only is Kevin Hart starring in a number of these, but Idris Elba has got a huge film coming out towards the end of the year called No Good Deed. I think he's got two tremendous stars that he's got a chance to work regularly with.
You also have a fun thing here. This is films that are coming up in this next year. I love this as a former kid who was forced to study Latin, involving some classic tales.
Well, we knew that you needed a little Greco-Roman. And so it turns out, believe it or not, between now and the Christmas holidays this year, there will be seven big-budget Hollywood films kind of taking you back to kind of Greco-Roman biblical topic. So you've got one on Pompeii. You've got a big one starring Russell Crowe called Noah. You've got a big one coming this summer on Hercules starring the guy formerly known as The Rock, now referred to as Dwayne Johnson. So it's kind of a funny little quirk.
Swords and Sandals are back, and that was something in your piece that I didn't realize that Pompeii has had something like 200 previous renderings in film.
Pompeii weighs in at 200. Hercules, 83 previous versions. Including one in January already. Hollywood is beating a theme in 2014.
Shifting to books now, ebooks are growing more and more popular, but you have a piece about e-lit that's published specifically for women.
Well, one of the most interesting things, Arun, that's happened is this hunger for something that's longer than a magazine article but shorter than a book. A couple of writers and executives, Peggy Northrup and Laura Fraser, looked up and saw some of the biggest services having 80 to 90% male writers and said, this is kind of crazy, given that 70% of the readers are women. And so they created something called shebooks.net with the idea of profiling and ultimately representing more and more female writers of these long, short stories, if you will. I went online to look at some of the really interesting ebooks they had, and what a tantalizing variety of memoirs, of interesting cooking books, travel features, mysteries, a really healthy mix in their first wave. They just launched in December, by the way, so a lot here is new.
Carlos Watson is the co-founder of the online magazine Ozzy. You can explore all the stories we talked about at npr.org/newandnext. Carlos, thanks again.
Arun, my pleasure. Look forward to seeing you next week.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. The unmistakable voices of Roebuck pop staples and his four children, Cleotha, Mavis, Purvis, and Yvonne. They were the Staple Singers, a group whose sound, mixing gospel, blues, and soul, broke down musical walls and inspired civil rights leaders. Greg Kot is the host of the public radio show Sound Opinions, and he's written a new book about the Staples family and their music. It's called I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, the Staple Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway. He says the roots of the Staple Singers go back to Pops, born and raised amid the music of a Mississippi plantation.
First of all, you take it back to Mississippi, where Pops grew up, Pop Staples, Roebuck Pop Staples. So he had an apprenticeship, as it were, in blues and gospel music on Dockery Farm in Mississippi. You know, he carried on that tradition with his own children in Chicago. And he had like a cheap guitar that only had four strings on it. It was like a secondhand pawn shop guitar. But it was enough strings so that he could play a note and give each child their particular harmony part. And those were the harmony parts that stayed with them for the rest of their lives.
It wasn't like we'd form a quartet, we want a tenor, we want a soprano. It's these are the voices we have in the family, and that's the sound.
Yeah, there's something about being around people all your life, growing up with them, hearing them talk, hearing them just sing off key, hearing them yell at you, you know instantaneously where the phrase is going to drop, where the syllable is going to be, where how words, certain words are going to be pronounced. Being around each other, you cannot replace that. And those harmonies lasted with them a lifetime.
I got a home, got a home beyond the sky.
Let's talk about Uncloudy Day, which is probably their breakthrough, right?
Yeah, Uncloudy Day was the song that put them on the national map. They had already become sort of regional favorites at that point, but this was the one that made them a national phenomenon. And it was an old song. It's a song that had been around since the 19th century. It was familiar to any African-American who had attended a church service by that point. I mean, it was so steeped in the vernacular, but nobody did it quite like the Staple Singers did it. It had sort of this almost ancient vibe about it, and it created this sort of wave of nostalgia, people feeling very nostalgic about where they had come from, and I think that was one of the reasons it became one of the biggest gospel songs ever.
Well, in a world,
You write about how they ended up making that transition to really become an everyman's group and had crossover with white audiences. And can you explain that, how they were embraced by this folk movement?
You have to understand, in this group, you had several generations blending. You know, Pops was a traditionalist, no doubt about it. He was a very staunch gospel man. But his sensibility, he was an open-minded guy, and part of it was his children were listening to everything. You know, Purvis Staples was doing a battle of the bands with Sam Cooke and Lou Rawls on Sunday afternoons. So there was a lot of influences sort of filtering in through the music, and I think Purvis especially was very much about, you know, pushing forward. He was an early friend of Bob Dylan, saying, you know, we got to check this guy out. We should be singing some of this stuff. And Pops being open-minded enough to start incorporating them into the group's own music, because I think he saw it as a way of, you know, we are not discriminatory in who we sing for or who appreciates our music. We want to be heard by as many people as possible, and he wanted to send out an empowering message to those people.
And that empowering message became really wrapped up along with the civil rights movement.
Yes, they were close friends with Martin Luther King Jr. Pops and Martin Luther King were friends. They were mutual admirers. He would say, "Stape, when are you going to play my song? Hope you're going to play my song tonight." You know, he loved "Why Am I Treated So Bad," a Staple Singers classic.
I'm gonna walk out in the master name. Things I do, they seem to be in vain.
And the Staple Singers were King's ambassadors in Chicago when he brought the movement north. He said, you know, you got to come sing so that I can get this guy, Jesse Jackson, involved in the campaign for civil rights in Chicago. And really, they were intimately tied with the civil rights movement throughout the 60s.
It was not too much longer after that, just later in the 60s, where it seemed for a brief time that that time had kind of passed by the Staple Singers, like they had maybe kind of that they had peaked. And then they have this, I don't know if it's a third act or a fourth act when a band has been around, yeah. The group has been around that long, but how did the Stax Records revitalization happen?
Al Bell, the president of Stax Records, had the group, instead of recording in Memphis with the Booker T and the MGs rhythm section, had them try something in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Once the Staples hooked up with the Swampers in Muscle Shoals, something clicked. A great example would be, you know, I'll Take You There. It's almost a cliche. Everybody's heard that song countless times, but they said, the guys at Muscle Shoals told me, that song basically had five lines of lyrics in it, and the rest was completely improvised on the floor of the studio.
Wow.
So that was Mavis Staples interacting in real time with that rhythm section. That was the kind of bond these people had. And every one of them, they said to this day, the single greatest performance we have ever witnessed was Mavis Staples singing with us on that particular track. In gospel, you respond to the moment. You're in the moment. You have the Holy Ghost moment. The Spirit walks into the room, and it changes everything. And that's what Mavis felt that day on the floor at Muscle Shoals, and it's really a transcendent piece of music.
It's so unique. It's so its own thing and its own sound, the way you're talking about it. And you said that, you know, it's something that almost can't be duplicated. So how would you discuss the legacy, the influence of that sound?
Well, I think the key thing here to me is that Mavis Staples is one of the great performers of our time. Her investment in everything she sings is total, and that's apparent from the first note to the last. There is no phoning it in with Mavis Staples. Hmm. You hear a song like On Cloudy Day, or you hear a song like Respect Yourself. I mean, there is no doubt that this person is in the moment. She believes, and that makes you believe.
That's Greg Kot. He's the author of I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staple Singers, and The March Up Freedom's Highway. He joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure, Erwin. Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. This year, Ford is marking the 50th anniversary of the Mustang. To celebrate, engineers came up with a major redesign, featured this week at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. But before it revealed the new model, Ford tried to preserve the element of surprise. That's no easy task when you're up against paparazzi from car magazines and websites. NPR's Daniel Hajek reports on one way automakers keep away prying eyes: car camouflage.
For months, the new Mustang was cloaked in secrecy. But an upcoming car can't stay in the garage forever. It has to undergo rigorous testing, and that means taking it out in traffic to monitor its handling on roads across the U.S. So to keep the redesign out of the public eye, Mustang chief engineer Dave Parasek says it was completely covered in camouflage.
Underneath that material is a whole science and art all in one. They're creating a new exterior over the exterior.
It's like hiding in plain sight.
We try to use lightweight vinyl and different types of foam which don't absorb water.
That's Al Wilkinson, the Mustang's master of disguise. He's Ford's camouflage coordinator. Wilkinson says he carefully designed the fake exterior so it wouldn't affect the weight or aerodynamics of the car.
The materials we use have to be flexible and also be able to hold up to all different weather climates.
The result? A nondescript black boxy vehicle that looks a little like the Batmobile. Just as soon as it hit the road, the car paparazzi were waiting.
Heavily camouflaged, but I have photos of the Mustang.
That's photographer Brenda Pretty. She caught it outside a shopping mall in Colorado. You can't tell what the design looks like, but even photos of masked cars are sought after by auto magazines and blogs.
Everybody loves to see the next Corvette, the next Mustang, the next Ferrari. They like to see what's going on.
Pretty says each auto company has a distinct style of camouflage. BMW and Mini mount psychedelic black and yellow patterns on exteriors to distort the contours and lines.
We've seen lots of Nissans and in the past a couple Subarus that look like they're wrapped in garbage bags with black electrical tape or duct tape wrapped around it. So that's pretty distinctive as well.
She says one of the best spots to snap spy photos is at a gas station.
We usually wait until they get the nozzle on the gas pump and then they're kind of stuck there for a few minutes. Just kind of blend in and we belong where they belong.
Pretty takes her pictures in public places, but not everyone plays by those rules. During the Mustang's high-speed tests, Dave Parasek says one photographer snuck past security onto Ford's private track.
He went to the track the night before and slept in the weeds. And then in the morning, he was ready to go, and he had his telephoto lens and everything, and he literally just woke up in the weeds. And as we rolled the car off of our transportation truck and we took the camo off, his camera started snapping photos. Even though we had hired security and closed the track down and did everything that we did, he still got his way in there.
Images of the Mustang's front end were leaked, but that didn't compromise the car's much-anticipated unveiling.
Everybody has a great story about the Mustang.
Ford's chief operating officer Mark Fields addresses a crowd in Dearborn, Michigan in December. He stands in front of a Mustang hidden under a white sheet.
So with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the all-new 2015 Mustang.
The sheet flies off the car, finally revealing the glossy red, fully redesigned body. Parasek says the camouflage did its job.
It's a big game of cat and mouse, and at the end of the day, as long as we don't get caught by the cat, we're good.
With bulky and sometimes vibrant camouflage, it's hard to miss these future cars out on the road. The car paparazzi will always have lenses pointed towards the latest redesign. But as long as there are camouflage coordinators, the car industry's newest design secrets can stay safely hidden until the next big reveal. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth.
Hi, I'm Carl Sagan.
A few months before astrophysicist Carl Sagan died in 1996, he recorded a message to the future human inhabitants of Mars.
I don't know why you're on Mars, but whatever the reason you're on Mars is, I'm glad you're there, and I wish I was with you.
Some of the earliest science fiction back in the 19th century imagined voyages to the red planet. We have spacefaring technology today, and getting to Mars actually seems within reach. But it would involve massive resources and a lot of danger. There are a lot of people, though, willing to risk it all for that chance.
Everything I've done academically and professionally has been for one reason, to leave this Earth and represent humanity on Mars.
Army Lieutenant Heidi Beamer. To get to Mars sooner, she's willing to forego the return trip. That's right, a one-way ticket to the red planet. We'll hear more from her later. A private organization wants to start a permanent human colony with volunteers like Beamer by 2025. That's our cover story for today. Humans on Mars, the risks and the reward. A few years ago, President Barack Obama set out a more conventional goal for the mid-2030s.
I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow. And I expect to be around to see it.
Earthlings have actually been visiting Mars since the 1960s, or at least our machines have. First, there were flyby missions, then orbiters. Early primitive landers in the 1970s sent back the first pictures from the surface. But the real excitement began with the robotic rovers that started exploring the surface of Mars in the 1990s. NASA took a big leap forward when it landed the rover Spirit and Opportunity on opposite sides of the planet.
We're on Mars, everybody.
John Grant is a planetary geologist at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and part of NASA's rover mission team.
I don't want to admit that I pretend that I'm a robot on Mars, but clearly the science team kind of places themselves in the eyes and body of the rover when we look around, almost like we're there.
So we've learned so much about Mars in recent decades, you know, from the rovers and also from the orbiters that have been mapping the surface of the planet. But I imagine there's probably still a ton that we don't know.
So think if you had all the continents on the Earth to explore and you've only been to a handful of places, would you say that you really kind of understand the Earth? And of course, the answer would be no. And that's the situation on Mars. The surface area on Mars is about the same as the land area on the Earth. We feel like in some cases we've been to a couple of national parks, but there's a bunch more we need to get under our belt.
You must be familiar with the old unsettled debate that is it worth sending humans into deep space beyond Earth orbit when robots can do so much and we've seen them do so much. Am I wrong to assume that you're with the robots?
No, actually, I'm in both camps. I think that the robots are critical to setting the stage, to understanding what's there, and to doing the sort of precursor. But let's consider that Opportunity in 10 years has gone about a little over 38 kilometers, a bit more than running a marathon on the Earth. I'm no Olympic athlete, but over 10 years, I could certainly walk, even very slowly, many, many times that many marathons. With the rovers, it's a much more sort of dragged out process simply because we have to tell them every day what to do. It just takes longer.
Even John Grant, a member of NASA's robotic rover team, thinks a manned mission is necessary. But there are a ton of concerns about sending people to Mars, not the type of stuff you can sort out after launch. And once you're off, it's a long trip. The shortest Mars trip would take more than a year round trip. So here on Earth, scientists are conducting experiments at sites built to simulate these long-duration missions. Kim Binstead is the principal investigator at one of these sites, located on one of Hawaii's volcanoes.
It's not the Hawaii you're used to thinking of and seeing ads for tourism.
Binstead, a professor at the University of Hawaii, says there's no plant life around, no human activity visible. For the studies, crews live inside of a geodesic dome for months at a time.
It's very small. It's about 1,000 square feet for 6 people. And that includes their workspace, their sleeping space, kitchen, laboratory, and so on. And the crew can only go outside in spacesuits, mock-up spacesuits. So they really are in those tight quarters without a lot of relief for quite a long time.
And for a long-duration mission such as that, one of the first things you think about is how do people eat? So how do they manage the food situation?
Right. Well, our first mission, which finished in August, was all about the food. We had both the completely pre-prepared food, which is similar to what NASA uses now, and we allowed the crew to do some basic cooking using shelf-stable foods.
I know another one of the big concerns when talking about a mission like this is the psychological concerns about having people being stuck in the same environment with the same people for a very extended period of time.
Right, and that's what our next 3 missions are looking at. We've got funding from NASA to do 3 more missions, and those missions are all going to be about psychology, crew cohesion, crew performance. Basically, how do you support a crew and pick a crew so that they don't end up wanting to kill each other?
And getting to Mars is only half the problem. Getting back is another thing entirely. Just think about all it takes to get a simple satellite into Earth orbit. Now, imagine launching a trip home from Mars. How do you pack your own launch pad, rocket, and the ridiculous quantity of fuel it takes to get home? One group of Mars enthusiasts is getting around all of that by saying, forget going home. Mars One is a Netherlands-based nonprofit. They have the goal of establishing a permanent, sustainable human settlement on Mars by 2025. First, they'd send a series of robots to build a habitat and stockpile water. But their plan still faces a ton of serious problems, like potentially lethal levels of radiation on the Martian surface and the extreme Martian weather. There's still a lot of money to be raised, and the company is looking to crowdfunding for some of it. John Logsdon is the former director of the Space Policy Institute, and he says the idea is more fantasy than fact in his mind.
It's not clear what they would do once they get there except be there. You know, it's not impossible, but I think it's very highly implausible.
But that has not deterred more than 200,000 people from around the world from applying. Just over 1,000 made it to the second round. 25-year-old Heidi Beamer is one of them.
I actually decided and told my parents when I was 8 years old that I was going to be an astronaut and I was going to go to Mars.
Heidi Beamer is in the Army. She's a lieutenant and chemical defense officer with Fort Campbell's 63rd Chemical Company in Kentucky. To most, the concept of a one-way trip to another planet seems daunting and disturbing, even crazy. Beamer's mind is made up.
The thought of being afraid or having the fear of the fact that I'm going to die on a different planet, it doesn't really bother me because this is something that will help out humanity for years and years and years to come. So if I'm going to die anywhere on Earth or anywhere, I might as well die doing something that's going to help out future generations.
Her passion for the red planet goes back to an article she read in 1997 about the landing of NASA's Sojourner rover.
From this newspaper article, on the top was this giant panorama that was taken of just the Mars surface. And as a little 8-year-old kid, I'm looking at this going, wow, like, this is awesome. We need to continue to explore this. And this little rover can only do so much. We need to send people.
Mars One still has a lot of details to work out, but here's the plan for now. The final round of astronauts will be selected in 2015. 40 to 50 astronauts will be selected. They'll spend the next decade training at stations just like the one in Hawaii. Starting in 2024, the first set of four astronauts will set off on the one-way journey. Beamer says she's already connected with some of the other applicants.
So there's a Facebook group called the Aspiring Martians Group, and this is a community of over 3,000, 4,000 people that all have aspirations of one day going to Mars. We've been talking, we've been communicating, we've been discussing what-if situations, we've been kind of being really supportive of each other.
And these people seem like the type of people that you would literally like to spend the rest of your life with. What do you think about the social aspect of this, about, you know, having a life and a family eventually?
I think moving forward, I'm okay with it. Creating a new family that I am ultimately going to bond with for the rest of my life is kind of a good consolation to just settling down with one person and having a family of my own. I'm really looking forward to it kind of growing into a giant extended family.
How does your family feel about the prospect of you going to Mars and never coming back?
They're super supportive. They, of course, are nervous and they're a little afraid. But my senior year of high school, I told my family, hey, I've decided that I'm going to go to a military school. And then after my senior year, I came home and said, Mom and Dad, I've decided that I'm going to serve my country and I'm going to be joining the Army. So once I finally sat down and said, Mom and Dad, I've applied to go to Mars on a one-way trip, I think this is kind of the point where they realize, okay, this kid's going to continue to surprise us and continue to do great things. So they're coming to realization with that.
So even though you've got through to this cut, it's still pretty long odds at this stage. If Mars One doesn't work out, do you have a plan B?
If this doesn't work out, it's just a matter of time before more opportunities come across. Regardless, my goal is to continue getting people excited about space. For me, just spreading the word about it and getting the younger generations excited about the project is something that I'm going to continue doing for the rest of my life, whether I'm on Earth or on Mars.
Heidi Beamer is one of 1,058 applicants still in the running for a one-way trip to Mars. And by the way, Kim Binstead, the scientist from the Mars Simulation Habitat in Hawaii, is also a finalist for Mars One. As she put it, how could she not apply? With all of the unknowns, engineering and funding challenges, and safety risks, there's still a hope pulsing through the scientific community that humans will soon walk on Mars. We are collecting stories of triumph, big and small. The moments when people make those great leaps forward in their careers. We're calling it My Big Break, and we're kicking off our series with a break that happened 24 years ago today, thanks to one lucky photograph.
My name is Bill O'Leary. I'm a staff photographer with the Washington Post. My big break came the night Washington Mayor Marion Barry got arrested for smoking crack in a hotel room during an FBI sting. Leading up to that point, I had been administrative staff at the Post. It's pretty much clerical background work. And I was anxious to get out on the street with a camera, you know, make a real contribution. So I got a new boss who gave me an internship. So a month into this internship, an editor comes running in and says, there's a rumor that the mayor has been arrested. For this to be happening was a monstrous local story. It's true, the mayor has been arrested. He's being held at the FBI Buzzard Point Center. And we are going to flood the zone. We're going to have people at every intersection and every corner of the building, and we're going to get the mayor when he comes out of that building. So they dispatch all of the heavy hitters off to their assignments, and there's two or three people left, just me and one of the older photographers who had been going through a divorce and had asked for light duty. So my boss looks at us and he says, and you two guys, why don't you go out to his house just in case we miss him? It's now close to midnight. It's January. It's very cold and dark and quiet. My colleague takes the front of the house and I take the back. the back of the house is off of an alley. And sure enough, vehicle pulls up, SUV with smoked windows, and the door opens, and four men get out. And damn, there he is. There's Marion Barry. So I raise my camera, but before I can take a picture, this big, beefy FBI agent blocks me, puts his hand on my lens, and starts pushing me back. At that moment, I hear a commotion, and at the end of the alley, a competitor, Joe Johns of Channel 4 News, he has arrived at the end of the alley. He's seeing that he's missing it, so he's taken off on foot, and he's yelling at the top of his lungs, "Mr. Mayor, and what were you doing in that hotel room?" Something like that. Well, this alarms the FBI agent, who stops worrying about me and turns to intercept this new threat. At that instant, I get off this one picture, bam, with a punch flash, direct strobe, hideous in the middle of the night. So I get in the car and I go rushing back. Go running into our dark room, close the door and lock it, begin the process. When I finally start to unwheel it from the spool, hold it up to a light box, and there it is. It's clear, it's sharp, it's properly exposed, and it's the mayor. It was our lead picture, an incredible scoop. Everyone wanted it. We got picked up by all the wires, all the magazines. It was magic, is the only way to describe it, I think. And that's what happened. That was my big break.
That was Bill O'Leary. He's a staff photographer for The Washington Post. We want to hear the story of your big break. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. Did you notice a theme running through the Oscar nominees for Best Picture?
I was born a free man, lived with my family in New York.
Be good for your mother.
Until the day I was deceived.
To Solomon.
Kidnapped, sold into slavery.
I know this woman. She had a baby when she was a teenager. She's kept it secret for 50 years.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
12 Years a Slave, Philomena, Wolf of Wall Street, along with American Hustle, Captain Phillips, and Dallas Buyers Club, they're all based on true stories. Real life, racial injustice, slavery, the Holocaust, they all seem like pretty reliable picks for Oscar nods. In February, the American Sociological Review will publish a paper about these kinds of movies, the so-called Oscar bait. Gabriel Rossman is a professor at UCLA, and he's the lead author of the study. He says they were interested in the Oscar bait formula because it was key to a high-stakes bet.
Making a movie with high Oscar appeal, a movie that's targeted towards the Oscars, you really have to get the Oscars or it doesn't work, because people don't necessarily like the kinds of movies that are seeking Oscars unless they get the Oscars, in which case they actually do like them quite a bit.
Because, you know, some of these subjects, whether it's, you know, racial injustice or, you know, slavery, the Holocaust, they're not things that people necessarily want to think about or spend a lot of time with.
That's right. The kinds of things that tend to get you Oscars tend to be unpleasant. And so we found that what tends to get you Oscars is biopics or historical films, to a slightly lesser extent, drama or war. Sci-fi, horror, and action are pretty bad for getting you Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Next most important thing was the plot themes. Stereotypically, it's themes having to do with disabilities or war crimes, such as the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually pretty good for getting Oscars, but not quite as good as things having to do with aristocrats or political scandal.
I see.
So things having to do with Watergate or something like that, they bury the needle. And then the other things that count a lot are a late release date. Obviously, these films all come out in award season, close mm-hmm. to Christmas. And also, very often, they're released by specialty divisions of major studios that really specialize in these types of films.
But even when a film hits all of those points, it's not really a guarantee. Your paper says the movie that actually had the most Oscar appeal from 1985 to 2009 was this 1990 film about a couple split apart by the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II.
At a time when the world was at war, they were stripped of their possessions.
What are you burning?
I don't want people going through our things.
Do you think they'll send us back to Japan?
I don't know.
I've never been to Japan.
And their freedom.
My wife is an American citizen, sir.
You think the camps are wrong?
Yes, sir, I do.
Yeah, so we got family tragedy, racial injustice, historical setting. It feels like Come See the Paradise is they're just piling it on.
Coming up with movies like this was actually the whole point of the study, because if every movie that's trying to get an Oscar actually gets an Oscar, then we wouldn't have bothered to try and figure out which movies are trying. We could have just looked at which ones succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
So it was actually in order to identify films like Come See the Paradise that tried but failed to achieve Oscars. That's why we went through all this trouble and writing thousands of lines of computer code. Of course, the irony is that once the computer's flagged such a film for you, nobody's heard of it. People don't like these kinds of movies unless they get the Oscar nomination. And I think it's worth noting that Come See the Paradise lost a lot of money.
And we can go to the other end of the scale now with a film, another film I'd not heard of before, that scored one of your lowest rankings on the scale.
Think they belong to anyone? If they did, would they be here? Better here than the pound. Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Oh yeah, why don't we just wander the streets and rescue every stray we see?
That is, of course, the 2009 classic Hotel for Dogs, which finished second to last in your ranking. So you're telling me that that's not Oscar material, huh?
Well, it might very well be a fine film, but it's but it's not the kind of thing that the people had to return a deposit on their tuxedos. This is a good example of the kind of film that's not remotely targeted towards the Oscars. First of all, the genres are comedy and family. Comedy is not that bad, but family films almost never get Oscar nominations. Also, it came out in January. And it has keywords like dog that tend not to be especially highly ranked as Oscar-friendly keywords.
Have you been able to do any calculations about this year's movies?
No, I'm afraid not. It takes a few weeks of work, but just eyeballing it, it looks like these films would all score very highly on the metric.
Gabriel Rossman is a sociologist at UCLA. Dr. Rossman, thank you.
Thank you.
Captain Phillips is one of those films, a true life story of war and drama. It's based on the story of the hijacking of the Maersk, Alabama. 5 years ago, pirates attacked the freighter ship off the coast of Somalia. The film stars Tom Hanks as the title character, Captain Richard Phillips, and Barkat Abdi as the man who leads the charge to capture the ship and crew.
Look at me. Sure. Look at me. Sure. I'm the captain now.
But here's where the formula gets upended. Hanks was ignored in the Best Actor category, and first-time actor Barkat Abdi was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. It's not just his lack of movie experience that makes Abdi an unlikely Oscar nominee. Abdi was born in Somalia. His family moved to Yemen when he was 7, and he didn't get to the U.S. until he was 14. When I spoke with him last October, he told me that he learned about the Captain Phillips role from a TV ad.
Casting call, Tom Hanks film, Somali actress. And I went there to give it a chance.
So just a wide open casting call, and had to have been a lot of people showed up for that, right?
Yeah, it was about close to 800 people was there auditioning. You have to wait in line, and after a long day of waiting, I was given a script. I was assigned to a character, Musi.
Captain,
the ship's broken.
Captain, no one get hurt if you don't play no game.
The ship's broken. We had to go.
Nobody gets hurt.
Have you done any acting before?
You know, I have not done any acting before. I shot some music videos, but I was never in front of camera. Then this was my first time acting or even thinking about acting.
You knew the story that the film was portraying. Did you have any concerns about auditioning for a role like this, worried about maybe the way that Somalis were going to be portrayed?
Well, people around me did, you know, but to me, it was just an opportunity. I knew it was a true story, so it was just a chance that I can take.
Stop the ship!
I'm thinking about some of the scenes in the film where this tiny little skiff is attacking this giant shipping vessel.
Right.
What was it like, learning how to go through that and doing the staging of it?
You know, I went through about a month and a half of training on the basics of the film, you know, my character, you know, he's a pirate. He is someone that's used to the waters, someone that's used to weapons, fighting, skiffs. So I had to learn all that. Most importantly, I had to learn how to swim.
You didn't know how to swim?
No.
Obviously, you're not a pirate, so how was it, you know, not being an actor, to relate to this character? I mean, what did you find in him to relate with?
It was difficult at first, but, you know, when I really thought of the actual character, he's a very desperate guy that have this only chance to be something. I relate to him simply because I was born in Somalia. I lived there till I was 7 years old, and I witnessed a whole year of the war, killings, rape, you name it. I was really blessed to have parents that got me out. Certainly he did not have that. I look at him as someone that have nothing to lose. Man that have nothing to lose is very dangerous. So that's how I became his character.
Can I ask you, what was it like working with Tom Hanks?
It was an honor, you know, it was an honor. I did not expect him to be that nice, honestly. He's a very humble guy, and he's a hardworking man.
You came to America when you were 14. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you when you first came to America?
You know, it was exciting, but at the same time, it was life-changing. I had to start high school at a country that I don't speak the language, and it was hard. At the same time, it was easy because of the large Somali community in Minneapolis. I fit right in, honestly. It was just a whole new life for me.
You're off to a pretty amazing start as an actor. Your performance has been praised by a lot of critics. I'm wondering, are you going to keep on with this now as a career?
You know, that's what I want to do. I want to give it a chance, and I want to see if this was the only character I can act or I can act.
Are there other sorts of roles you'd like to play? Would you like to play a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero, honestly, but I'm an open person, you know, I don't know. That'd be a better look for my family, I guess.
Right. With this incident that's dramatized in the film Captain Phillips, a lot of Americans, you know, all they know about it was what they heard in the news. And there's, I think it's safe to say in the film, there's a lot more context to the experience of the Somalis. What are you hoping that people will take away from the film in America?
I hope people will understand the culture clash between these very, very different characters, Captain Phillips and Musi. You know, one had just the normal life, you know. He went to school, college, graduated, family, and now he have a job. And the other one is just someone that grew up in a war-torn country that have, you know, no hope, no school, no job, no government, nothing. And they meet in something that's on forces outside of their control. And, you know, that shows a lot about life. You live life and, you know, you have to survive somehow, some way, and, you know, you just live it, you know, and you never give up and you just keep going.
That's actor Barkhad Abdi from a conversation that first aired back in October. Abdi was just nominated for a Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his role in the film Captain Phillips. If you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. If you've been missing Bobby Bottle Service, the gals from Publicity, or Too Much Tuna, you can rejoice that comedian Nick Kroll is back with a new season of his sketch show on Comedy Central, Kroll Show. If what I just said makes absolutely no sense to you, don't worry. I asked Nick Kroll to start us off by explaining the background of one of those signature creations, the seedy, goateed, wannabe ladies' man named Bobby Bottle Service.
Arun, I'm shocked to think that anyone listening to NPR on a Sunday might not know where Bobby Bottle Service came from.
Just a couple of people.
But Bobby Bottle Service started as a character that I did as a way to talk to girls because he really loves to hit on women. And a lot of women have experienced getting hit on by a guy like Bobby Bottle Service.
I think of myself as like a very cool, very white Jay-Z.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm straight up looking for Beyonce.
Soon after I came up with him, Jersey Shore premiered, and it was a very similar kind of guy at that time. A lot of Ed Hardy clothing. And for those of you who don't know what Ed Hardy clothing looks like, it looks like someone splattered rhinestone diarrhea all over a sweatshirt.
You're ahead of the time, though, because I had always assumed that Bobby Bottle Service came after Jersey Shore.
Yeah, no, he came before it, and out of that, we started doing, with my friend John Daly, the Ed Hardy Boys, which was Bobby and Peter Paparazzo, and they were solving crimes like the Hardy Boys, but always in Ed Hardy clothing. The fun thing with Bobby is that he changes format, so in one sketch, it's Ghost Bouncers, like a parody of the Ghost Hunters show, because we watch Ghost Hunters and we're like, oh my God, these guys are real life Bobby Bottle Service.
Okay, I'm Bobby Bottle Service, aka Bobby Bottle Service. I have a great desire to know the unknowable, to see the unseeable, to understand paralegal activity, aka ghosts.
But they're, you know, bouncing ghosts out of a haunted house. And in this season, we find Bobby doing a bunch of different things. They run out of money, Peter and Bobby, and so they have to become very much reluctant gigolos. Their guide and mentor is Peter Gallagher.
Great cameo from him.
A great cameo from Peter Gallagher. And then they meet Jason Mantzoukas, who's a rival gigolo, and he invites them to live in his gigolo house.
After defusing a tense showdown with a breath mint.
Exactly. Breath mints bring everybody together in the gigolo community.
I want to talk about my favorite recurring segment, which is Wheels Ontario. Mm-hmm. There's a new installment, great new installment, that will be airing this week. For those who haven't seen it, can you describe Wheels Ontario?
Yeah, Wheels Ontario is a sort of a parody of Degrassi High. For those of you who don't know, Degrassi is a Canadian teen soap that has been on for, I think, like 25 years.
And that's something that I think the NPR audience is probably a significant crossover with
Degrassi. I think so.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Little Prairie Home Companion, switch on Degrassi for an episode, then come back for a little All Things Considered, go back for another episode of Degrassi, and then finish off the day with This American Life.
Yeah,
and you
pretty
got
much
yourself quite a Sunday. But yeah, so Degrassi is this Canadian teen soap, and so we created the show called Wheels Ontario, and the idea is that I am new at a school, and everyone at the school is in a wheelchair except for me.
You get picked on for that reason, for being...
Hey, what the...
Hey, legs. Thanks for the loony.
Pardon, I think you took my milk money. My name is Mikey. I'm new in school and I...
Shush up. If I call you Legs, your name is Legs, Legs.
Tu as les jambes très laides.
Pardon me. Part of that is based on the fact that Drake, the recording artist Drake, got his start as a kid in a wheelchair on Degrassi. I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's like the drama on Degrassi and translated into Wheels Ontario is super high stakes, but... The acting and performances, like Canada, are pretty bland.
Yeah, the tone doesn't waver even when they're going through awful, you know, whatever awful thing they're going through. It's that same kind of...
Pregnancy, drug abuse, attempted murder, statutory rape, all these things that are hugely important are played with very low-end emotion.
So this is great, but I just want to keep talking, but we have to stop at one point. I'll ask you one more. Maybe what might be considered a real breakout role is on the FX show The League. I wonder, though, I mean, you've been able to play a lot of different characters. Was it hard after such a kind of pungent role as that not to get typecast as a jerk?
The character I play in The League, Ruxin, I thought was going to be one of the most unlikable guys ever to be on television. And he is to an extent, but people seem to enjoy him because he's kind of funny, like he's supposed to be funny. So he can be a jerk, but he's also making jokes. And I've always wanted to do my own show and play a bunch of different characters. And so being able to play a bunch of different characters has given me a break from just playing this one kind of guy. And I'm very lucky that I get to do that. It's incredibly gratifying to be able to play a wide spectrum of characters, but ones that you can always come back to and learn more about. And like your friends, you have some friends who you hate, and then you're like, oh, but they have a terrible mother. And you're like, okay, I accept them for who they are because I met their mother and I see that they never got complimented. And I feel that same way about all my characters, that, you know, you try to find the humanity even in the most mean-spirited people.
That's Nick Kroll. He's the creator and star of The Kroll Show. Its second season just premiered this past week. Nick, thank you.
Thank you so much.
For the week ending January 19th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Chris Keneally, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, and Francesca Fenzi. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leah DeLaguila and Marcia Caldwell. Tom Dreisbach is standing in for Mathoni Maturi as senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week, and remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.